Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank. We're going to spend the next hour digging into the most pressing national security issues. And if you enjoy my particular take, there is quite a bit more on Twitter at @Uncle_Jimbo. President Trump ran on a platform saying he would defeat radical Islamic terrorism. It was a signature issue and completely differentiated him from President Obama, who did everything in his power to whitewash the Islam out of the issue. But it's not quite that simple, and any strategy to defeat it must take into account the terrorists and their supporters, but also the hundreds of millions of Muslims who don't share their beliefs. Lieutenant General McMaster, who is our new national security advisor, made some statements about the nature of our enemy that have some folks concerned. Specifically, he said terrorist organizations like Daesh or ISIS, who cynically use a perverted interpretation of religion to incite hatred and justify horrific cruelty against innocents. Well, the bottom line is, he's correct. Burning people alive in cages and slaughtering thousands for the perceived crime of not being devout enough is perverse and barbaric and uncivilized and not accepted by the vast majority of Muslims worldwide. Those acts are evil, and we can all join together to condemn them. But I don't think General McMaster's statements are inconsistent with President Trump's formulation and description of our enemy. So to join the two, you can accurately say, radical Islamic terrorism is a perversion of Islam. This accounts for the fact that the horrible savagery of ISIS is not compatible directly with Islam, but it also accounts for the fact that it is conducted by Muslims and in the name of their view of Islam. The prestigious Islamic university, Al-Azhar in Egypt, is the foremost proponent of what is and is not Islamic. And when they were asked whether ISIS was Islamic, they famously refused to declare them outside of Islam, and they said, "No believer can be declared an apostate regardless of his sins." That essentially puts them in the position of saying, love the sinner, hate the sins. The leader of ISIS, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, has a PhD in Islamic studies, and Al-Azhar, in making their statement, had to take into account some of its own curriculum, which, and I quote, allows for killing a Muslim who does not pray, one who leaves Islam, prisoners and infidels within Islam, gouging their eyes and chopping off their hands and feet, and discriminating between Muslims and Christians. Not quite ISIS, but still pretty awful. And this is the gold standard for Islamic thought. So we cannot completely detach Islam from those who put these concepts into action, which brings us back to the question of how to refer to our enemies. General McMaster has done more than almost any other U.S. military leader to co-opt former enemies and even members of terrorist groups into joining us in the fight against those groups. He has rightly noted that a blanket denunciation of Islam as the cause of all this is unhelpful in the cause of turning our enemies into allies or frenemies at best. He also rightly notes that we cannot kill our way to victory, but we must enlist the help of Muslims who don't wish to follow this return to the 7th century religion of conquest. But we also must accept that support for the supremacist ideology of radical Islam is considerably more widespread than just the terrorists. Radical Islam is a global threat, and any strategy to confront it must address its violent elements and also its ideology. and include a way to enlist the help of the many Muslims who don't share those beliefs. This enemy is a peculiar and challenging type. It has no central headquarters, is not run by a single rogue state, or comprised of one identifiable network. It has elements that are sponsored by states like Iran and Saudi Arabia, and even has one quasi-state entity in ISIS. But it is not one enemy or alliance that we could conduct a war against. That said, we must accurately identify this enemy to be able to successfully defeat it. So let's do that. In this case, there are two interconnected elements. The first of these is the groups that are all too familiar to all of us. ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, Hamas, Hezbollah, the usual suspects. There are many more, and they will rise and fall, so it's more important to note their beliefs and tactics rather than their names. And it should not be controversial that these groups are evil and should be eliminated. But these groups did not spring up in a vacuum. They represent a strain within Islam that believes in conquest and has declared itself at war with those who do not share its extremist beliefs. Now, that includes non-believers like us, but also many Muslims who it considers insufficiently devout. They have no compunction about killing anyone who does not submit to their view of the will of Allah. Now, there's a second tier of believers who may not agree with the barbaric tactics of ISIS, but who nonetheless share the view that Islam must be spread and become preeminent. They also agree that some level of violence, even against innocents, is acceptable in that pursuit. This is a not insignificant number of people. Now, if we have resolved to call these violent groups radical Islamic terrorists, then it is logical and accurate for us to call those who support them and their belief system in some way radical Islam. The number of Muslims this includes is difficult to accurately gauge, but we can get a good idea of the huge scope of the problem from the Pew International poll of Muslims worldwide. Support for the violent groups varies from country to country, but even the low estimates are in the 5 to 10% range, which is 100 to 150 million people. There is considerably more support for those who say the expansion and consolidation of Islam is good and required. And again, even the low estimates of that put it at 20 to 25%, which is 300 to 400 million people. Those folks are okay with violence in support of their cause. And in this poll, Pew was unable to conduct polling in some of the most militantly Islamic countries like Iran and Saudi Arabia because their pollers might have gotten killed. So these estimates are almost certainly well on the low end. Now, in their most recent major poll, they went ahead and asked one question that I think identifies just how widespread this problem is. They asked, "Some people think that suicide bombing and other forms of violence against civilian targets are justified in order to defend Islam from its enemies. Do you personally feel that this kind of violence is justified?" Now, the answers came out in never justified, often, sometimes, or rarely justified. Now, the answers were so stunning to Pew that they actually cheated the system and took the answer of violence against civilian targets is rarely justified as a negative response, as if those people had said, "No, I don't agree it's justified." No, they just said rarely, which means they'll decide when, and then it's okay. So when they published their results, they skewed them by adding that to the never justified to make the poll look less heinous. The actual number of Muslims in this poll, and this was 39 countries and 38,000 people, was 28% believed that in some way, shape, or form, violence against civilian targets in support of Islam is okay. That is scary. That can't be ignored. And that shows that this problem is not just the terrorist groups. There are a significant number of people who have decided their way of life and ours are incompatible. Additionally, they want to dominate the Muslim world and already have hundreds of millions of people under their sway in majority Islamic countries. Now, they don't represent all Muslims, for sure, but it's far too significant a number to ignore. We must have a strategy that accepts these are our enemies and responds accordingly. I'm Jim Hansen, and you're listening to Secure Freedom Radio. After the break, we'll talk with Chris Hull.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank. We're going to talk right now with Chris Hull, who is president of Issue Management Incorporated and a former chief of staff for Representative Steve King. But more importantly, right now, co-author of an outstanding op-ed and related longer study about why the White House needs an initiative to defeat radical Islam. Chris, welcome to the show. We have been talking for a long time about the, I guess, failed policies of the Obama administration, countering violent extremism, and any of their attempts to whitewash the Islam out of radical Islamic terrorism. So I think it's self-evident to most of us who aren't completely in the tank for the Obama version that this needs to happen. But tell us a little bit about what this study and plan points out and what is actually necessary as a first step to taking on an enemy that is much broader and deeper than a lot of folks want to admit.
Well, thanks very much, Jim. I appreciate the chance to be on here and appreciate the work that you do to keep America safe. So you're absolutely right. The Obama administration has really made a hash of this. And the first real, you know, public indications we had of it were during the campaign and some of the ridiculous things that his nominees said as they came up for confirmation hearings, including calling terrorism a man-made disaster. Unbelievable things that really ended up backfiring, in my view, in the war against radical Islam, as the president has termed it. And, you know, based on Donald Trump's understanding of that, he gave a terrific speech on August 15th, 2016, in Youngstown, Ohio, where he said, he talked about how he, as president, was going to make America safe again. And one of the concepts in there was to establish a commission on radical Islam. We really felt that that was an important proposal for him to make. And so the study that Middle East Forum and I worked together to do lays out in chapter and verse how such a commission could be structured, who should be on it, what kinds of people, what specific people, and then some ideas for how to make it successful.
Well, that sounds like an outstanding start. And I think I would agree with you that President Obama set the wrong tone and President Trump has corrected that. And I think the important piece, you know, you can talk about whether it's semantics or not to add the word Islamic to this entire discussion. But I think leaving it out is unfair to reality. And it also is unhelpful to the fact that we have to not just fight an enemy that is, you know, the terrorists, the Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, ISIS, the usual suspects. We have to fight the unfortunately large percentage of Muslims who support them. And it's not probably a majority. It's probably a smaller group. But then beyond that, you also have a group that supports supremacism, supports forced conversion, supports all the most dangerous elements of saying Islam must be supreme, Sharia must be the law, and we're willing to use force and violence to make that happen. Unfortunately, that group is somewhere in the 25 to 30% or larger of Muslims worldwide, and we need to face that fact.
Absolutely right. And not only do we need to face that fact, you know, I'd go a step further. I'd say that the Obama administration not only refused to use the words, but they actually brought the enemy into the process and let the enemy run the process for them. And I'll give you an example, Jim. In 2010, the Obama administration convened a Countering Violent Extremism Working Group, CVE Working Group. And the participants that they put on the working group had said things like, quote, jihad as holy war is a European invention, unquote. That's a lie. Second, the caliphate's return is inevitable. That hopefully is untrue, but regardless, we don't want people thinking that to be on the commission that's trying to stop it. Third, Sharia is misunderstood. Well, it is misunderstood, but by the Obama administration, not by patriots like you and our allies. And finally, quote, Islamic terrorism is a contradiction in terms because terrorism is not Islamic by definition, unquote. That's the opposite of the truth. The truth is that terrorism is built into some of the core doctrines of Islam, and that we have to understand those who want to reform Islam are our allies, and those who want the current version that goes back 14 centuries to be encoded in American law are the enemy, whether they are flying planes into buildings or not.
Folks, we're talking with Chris Hull, co-author of a study that you can find at the Middle East Forum's website, meforum.org. It is calling for a White House commission on radical Islam. Now, Chris, okay, let's go a step further. Now we've named them. What do we do next? Because this is a complicated problem, and it's not something, I think, where you can kill your way to victory. All right, we need to change an awful lot of minds. So what's the second step after identifying the enemy?
So the way that we approached this was we said, let's put together a panel of people who are actually serious about defeating the enemy. And let's allow them to actually, without political correct boundaries on them, go through this process. And so once you've defined the enemy, the question is, how do you put together the group that can do this, that can answer your question? I could answer it for you, but frankly, you know more about this than I ever have. You face the enemy face to face. And so what we need is a group of warfighters and others. And so let me walk you through what I think the president's next step should be from an administrative standpoint. I think that he should put together, as he said, one of the first things that he should do in his speech tomorrow night to the joint session of Congress, he should say, I'm putting together a commission on radical Islam. And the first thing that has to be tackled is, what is its structure? And I think that to be successful, all of its members need to be selected by the president. Now, this is not common practice. Usually, one of these quote-unquote blue ribbon commissions who are going to go off for 5 years and write a book-length treatment and then come back and have it completely ignored, they are put together in this Frankenstein way. They're knit together from a group of representatives from the Republican Party, a group of the representatives from the Democratic Party. That is a recipe for disaster and total failure. Instead, the president should select people that he believes, as the only elected representative of all of the people of the United States, people that he believes will answer this question fairly and with the point of view that the American people just selected in the last presidential election. So that, I think, is the first step.
That seems wise because, obviously, like you said, everybody's got an opinion about how to do this. However, we did just make a pretty big decision, and this was one of the major issues that was under consideration. So I think it's fair to go ahead and put that back into a less inside the beltway only and convene a broader group of folks to talk about it.
Exactly right. And the second thing that I think that the president should do is to learn from the struggles of the Tower Commission, which had no ability to subpoena documents, compel testimony, grant immunity, and instead learn from the precedent of the Three Mile Island Commission, which did. And I believe that the Congress should give that power to this commission. Now, I have to say that as a political operative, I think that this would be a really tough fight because you'd actually have to get it through Congress. But I believe that the president should tell Congress that he wants this and he needs it, and then let opponents of that explain why they don't want a commission to defeat radical Islam to have the ability to actually get answers to its questions.
I'm in. Okay, I'm behind it. I will push it. I will do anything I can to help because this is a wise and solid idea. Folks, we've been talking with Chris Hull, president of Issue Management Incorporated, about his and Daniel Pipe's call for a commission on defeating radical Islam. Up next, we're going to talk with Gordon Chang. This is Jim Hansen, and you are listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank. We're talking right now with Gordon Chang. Gordon is the author of The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Let's talk about North Korea taking on the world first, Gordon. You've written an article that discusses how Pyongyang and Beijing are having some concerns and issues and potential problems, and how that affects both the economies on both sides and how some of North Korea's somewhat belligerent actions may be playing into all of that. What actually do you think is going on and driving that?
Right now, I think Beijing is extraordinarily upset and dismayed at North Korea. I think, though, the most important emotion in Beijing is a feeling of being disrespected by a country that they view as a vassal. You know, there are a number of explanations for Chinese actions right now. You know, there's the coal ban. Basically, the Ministry of Commerce said that it was not going to buy any North Korean coal through the end of this year. And people have interpreted that as a response to the intermediate range missile test by North Korea. I think that it was actually a response to the killing of Kim Jong-nam, the elder half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. And the reason is that the Chinese believe that the North Koreans are disobedient, and that has enraged them. But whatever the response right now, we know that relations between the two states are not very good. But let's remember, China supports North Korea not because the North Koreans are friendly, but because the North Koreans, however unfriendly they may be, are actually advancing Chinese interests. And so, therefore, even though we do have this spat right now, which could spiral downwards, and I think it will, but even though we have this spat, China will continue to back North Korea because they see the North Koreans keeping the U.S. off balance.
Now, that's been a kind of the status quo through many Kims, you know, through the past three Kims, I guess, because that's been, you know, the North Korean state can't survive without Chinese money and oil and food and other things. They basically are a failed state that continues to operate because of that. But they also have been a huge headache for us, and they're a huge headache for the world because of their nuclear program. You know, they're a proliferator, they're a threat to us directly, they're a threat to everyone in the region. So I get the fact that they're useful to the Chinese, but does there come a point, and is this potentially that point, where they're more trouble than they're worth?
Well, many academics in Beijing will tell you that. But where it counts, which is the Politburo Standing Committee and at the top of the People's Liberation Army, they still support North Korea. Chinese leader Xi Jinping views the United States as China's main strategic adversary. So no matter what the North Koreans do, I think that he will back North Korea. Remember, every time North Korea does something provocative, we send a Secretary of State or a National Security Advisor to Beijing, plead for Chinese assistance. The Chinese then are ruthlessly pragmatic. They get some concession out of the U.S. And remember that every time North Korea does something awful, it diverts us from or important from our perspective. So the Chinese just love this. You know, we don't spend as much time thinking about the South China Sea or these issues because we're trying to get Beijing's cooperation.
So they go ahead and intervene and referee us to, you know, essentially a payoff in most cases or a concession of some sort to get the North Koreans from rattling sabers and, you know, lobbing missiles farther than they should. And still, I guess that still makes sense and that doesn't really change. But the entire situation now where North Korea and apparently the latest Kim is somehow failing to understand that he is a vassal, that they are, you know, that dependent. Is it a failure to understand that, or does he somehow think he's got clout that he may not have?
Well, I think that Kim Jong-un understands North Korea does have clout. They're an independent actor. They can protect themselves, especially right now. They've got nuclear weapons, long-range ballistic missiles. They've got chemical and biological stocks. So right now, Kim doesn't think that he needs the Chinese that much, that they'll pay him anyway. And, you know, the Chinese know that North Koreans can launch missiles north and west as well as east and south. And so, you know, Kim realizes he can hold Beijing to ransom. So this is interesting. This is blowback. You know, the Chinese have supported the North Koreans in their weapons programs because they just assumed that North Korea would be more hostile to Washington than to Beijing. But it's starting to turn a little different right now. And so I think that, as a friend of mine, Thaddeus McCotter, the former Republican congressman, says that every puppet eventually thinks that it is the hand. And so, therefore, we're having a very interesting series of events right now.
China has many ways they could reassert their authority. And folks, we're talking with Gordon Chang about the worsening relations, or at least back and forth, between North Korea and China as to, as you said, who's the puppet and who is the master. Is it a situation where maybe they starve them out, or fuel them out, or slow them down, you know, just through those ways? Or could this escalate beyond that?
Well, I think China is trying to reduce the income that the North Koreans have, as a gentle reminder. I don't think that Beijing will actually starve North Korea because of the reasons I mentioned. And so at this point, we are going to see Beijing keep the North Koreans at least on life support. That has implications because we can also push China further. We can, for instance, unplug Chinese banks from the global financial system because they're involved in North Korea's illicit commerce. We can sanction all Chinese state entities for Beijing's support for North Korea. There are so many things that we can do, Jim. It's just a question of our political will. And we have not had it. We didn't have it in the Obama administration. We didn't have it in the Bush administration before that. And I do hope that the current occupant of the White House will have the will to defend the American people.
He has certainly used the word China more than any other candidate, I think, in U.S. presidential history. And it was not in a very friendly way. He seems to look at them definitely as an economic pirate in many ways. And so I'd like to see, like you said, does that translate into better security for us, or is there a potential, you know, for those economic issues to get in the way and potentially worsen things? It's going to be an interesting minefield for President Trump to try and walk through. Gordon, there's another issue here. Kim Jong-un, the supreme leader of North Korea, his brother or half-brother, Kim Jong-nam, was killed. Now, that seems to have actually thrown both North Korea and China into a little bit more of a concern. Do you see that as something that might continue to make this even more dicey?
Well, you know, at this moment, essentially the North Koreans have sent a propaganda blast against China, saying that China's dancing to the U.S. tune, that it is not a friendly neighbor. The Korean Central News Agency did not mention China by name, but clearly it was describing China in this very unfriendly propaganda. China has not responded, or at least its response has been, oh, you know, we maintain friendly relations with North Korea. So the Chinese are trying to act like the elder brother, as they traditionally have over the course of decades. But I think that essentially North Korea right now sees China as its primary adversary because it is the Chinese who are on their border. It is the Chinese over the course of millennia who have invaded Korean lands. And so therefore, you know, that boundary has moved hundreds of miles in both directions, even in the last 600 years. So at this particular time, you know, Beijing is dealing with an intractable situation. As a friend of mine, Stapleton Roy, the former American diplomat, said, no one has ever found a good way to deal with North Korea. And now the Chinese are learning that lesson themselves. You know, we're sort of bystanders in a sense. The Chinese right now are directly on the firing line. And if nothing else, I'm starting to enjoy this because of the blowback.
Well, let's hope it doesn't blow too far, but I kind of share that with you. You know, I mean, they've been playing this game for a long time. And like you said, it has been a useful cudgel for them to pummel the United States with. And It's not quite so much fun when the cudgel turns on you and animates itself. So that might be a new thing for the Chinese to deal with, and let's hope they handle it well. Thanks very much, Gordon Chang, who is the author of The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, two books which seem to have collided in the current events. This is Jim Hansen. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio. Up next, we will talk with Luis Fleischman.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We have the pleasure this segment of talking with Luis Fleischman, who is advisor for the Mengus Hemispheric Security Project at the Center for Security Policy, as well as author of the book Latin America in the Post-Chavez Era, The Threat to U.S. Security. Welcome to the show, Luis.
It's always a pleasure to be here, Jim.
Now, you wrote a piece that makes a point that I don't think has been made enough. There is a lot of talk about the problems of anti-Semitism, and it's one of the talking points that has come out that, you know, for a while, maybe President Trump didn't come out forcefully enough and condemn anti-Semitism, and the liberal media was making a little bit of hay about that, and I don't think it was justified, and so he did. But you write an article that says maybe the left needs to go ahead and condemn anti-Semitism as opposed to just pointing at the right and saying that we do. Explain a little bit about that.
Well, first of all, I mean, I think it is good. I mean, definitely anti-Semitism. It's true that lately there have been threats apparently by white supremacists or extremist classical anti-Semites on synagogues and community centers. And President Trump was asked to condemn it. I mean, it took some time, but eventually he came out condemning it. But what actually caught my attention, Jim, is the fact that the issue of anti-Semitism has not been raised at all, even though it has been in existence for a long time. And it's not necessarily coming from white supremacists, even though now there is kind of a renaissance. It came actually from what is called Arab nationalists, radical Islamists, with some support by left-wing elements. A lot of support, boycotts of Israel, boycotts of Israeli academics, anti-Semitism in campuses. These things are things that have been happening for a long time. Several states actually issued legislation against boycotts of Israel, but in general has not been condemned by public opinion in the same way that the anti-Semitism of white supremacists has been.
Now, you know, Luis, I want to bring up one point because I think there's been an awful lot of talk in the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is a horrible outfit, has posted, you know, all kinds of information claiming that there is a wave of hate crimes and all these things are happening. But then people start digging into them. And in many of these cases, it turned out that a lot of these Islamophobia crimes were actually faked by people who wanted to make it look like the right was doing things when actually they were fake hate crimes just to generate sympathy. And I'm concerned that potentially some of these anti-Semitic incidents, you know, the gravestones being tipped over and other stuff, need to be investigated as well before we just blanket condemn the right for having committed them.
Oh, definitely. Everything requires investigation. I think the police is on it, and usually the police is well-trained to investigate cases. But you're absolutely right. I think you need a conclusion of what it is. But let's assume for a moment that indeed it is the white supremacists, all right, that are committing all these crimes. That, you know, what is ironic about this, Jim, is that now, the other day, you know, a Swiss cemetery was vandalized in Missouri, and all of a sudden you had people who support boycotts of Israel and the isolation of Zionists, of the Zionists and the Jews that support Israel. They started a fundraising campaign to repair these cemeteries that have been vandalized. That means there is an hypocrisy here. They're trying to whitewash their anti-Semitism by basically coming up forcefully against another type of anti-Semitism, when in fact they themselves are creating a problem that is even worse, which is the isolation and the boycott of the state of Israel, the only Jewish state. And by separating themselves from anti-Semitism, and that is not true. So that is the problem that I am very concerned. How in our culture today the issue of anti-Semitism is being perceived. I'll give you an example. There is one particular institute today, ISGAP, the Institute for the Study of Antisemitism, that is trying to introduce antisemitism as a field of study in the universities. And when he presented that idea to one of the universities, the director of ISGAP was asked if he intends to spread Zionist propaganda. Now, that is the way in which the anti-Israel campaign is embedded in the mainstream elements of our academia and institutions. This, in my opinion, is even more serious than the incidents of anti-Semitism that we have been experiencing lately. You know, because it is, the culture is excluding a culture that is supposed to be liberal and open to everybody and pluralistic.
It's a shame that we have to deal with these things from apparently both extremes of the political spectrum. But I think it's particularly fair for you to point that out, that claiming this is only a right-wing problem is wrong. There are plenty on the left who have heinous feelings and commit heinous acts against Jews and hold those anti-Semitic views, and they need to be pointed out and shunned just as much. Folks, we're talking with Luis Fleischman. And Luis, I wanted to talk about another article you wrote about the elections in Ecuador and how this has basically turned the people out. And now there is an anti-fraud and anti-corruption revolt going on. Fill us in on the specifics of that.
Well, first of all, the elections in Ecuador, at this point, the situation is that the candidate of Mr. Correa, who is an ally of Chavez, who is also involved in a major scandal of corruption that has what is called an anti-American agenda as well. He didn't run for presidential elections, but he had somebody in his party running. According to the rules, if the candidate won 40% of the vote and has 10% more than the next candidate, there is no need for a runoff. However, if he gets less than that, I mean, there will be a runoff. Now, it took an election that usually you know the results within a few hours. It took 3 or 4 days to find the final results, which eventually the Electoral Council admitted that we needed to go to a runoff, to a second round. But the reason why it was delayed, it was because they tried to commit fraud in order to have the candidate of Mr. Correa winning the election. Now, the reality is that immediately when the delay, when people felt that this delay was intentional, people went out on the streets protesting. And this is what eventually forced the Electoral Council to admit that there is a need for a second round. Now, there is tremendous anger today in Latin America over corruption. Finally, you know, because corruption in Latin America has been in existence for a long, long time. But now we have major scandals of corruption whose epicenter is Brazil and several companies in Brazil. But everyone in Latin America is involved, and particularly the governments of the left, with bribes by major Brazilian companies that bribe politicians, top high politicians in many, many countries, including particularly in countries where the left actually rules. And that includes the candidate for vice president now of the ruling party, Mr. Glass. And what is interesting is that that revolt in Ecuador had also an echo in Bolivia. There were protesters in Bolivia against Evo Morales, also the feeling that there is corruption, that this left-wing government is getting wealthier and wealthier. You know, in the case of President Evo Morales, he ordered the construction of a museum dedicated to himself. It's a cult of personality. So today we are having a revolt of the people against governments of the left over corruption. Corruption now begins to be a major issue in Latin America after decades where the issue was ignored.
Well, that sounds like good news. I think it's horrible when we watch, you know, democracy perverted to essentially just put the same kleptocrats in power. So, Luis, thanks for shining a light on that. Folks, we've been talking with Luis Fleischman, and that's going to wrap up Secure Freedom Radio for today. Frank Gaffney will be back tomorrow with more ammunition for you in the war for the free world.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.